This episode of the Mighty Parenting Podcast is sponsored by Getting It Together Summit. I know finishing out the school year was seriously challenging for many families. Our teens being at home without normal access to friends, classes being taught online, parents having to take on the role of teacher, which often does not go well, and so many other aspects to being and learning at home. And we don't know what the fall will bring. Schools are trying to make plans, but even if they make a plan, they may not be able to follow through with that plan. Things may change before school starts. Things may change after school starts. And this leaves parents stressed and struggling. Well, the founders at mathcodes.com approached me about a summit they are putting on for parents to help them prepare for whatever is coming in terms of education for the next year. It's called the Getting It Together Summit, and they have assembled 34 speakers who are leading experts, experienced parents, and they're having revealing conversations and sharing information to help you explore alternatives to your child's education and a healthier, happier life through COVID-19 and beyond. But here's my question for you. Have you ever heard about or participated in a summit before? It's a great opportunity to get information from a variety of experts. They take place online, and each expert is scheduled to share information in their arena. The Getting It Together Summit is happening July 15th, 16th, and 17th, so it's really soon, and it's free to listen. You just go to the website, getting-it-together.heysummit.com, and use your email to register. Then you'll receive an email with details and instructions on where and how to listen. After you get that email, you can choose when you listen, who you listen to, and you can decide that you want to binge on all 34 speakers, or just pick and choose topics that really feel like a fit for you or is something that you want to learn more about. So who can benefit from this summit? Well, the summit is for parents who have concerns about kids going back to school. It's for parents who are reconsidering traditional education and wonder what else is available and how that would work. It is for parents who are afraid that if they take control of their child's education, they may ruin their kid's future. And it's for parents who are excited or energized about the idea of shaping their child's future. There are two main areas to the Getting It Together Summit. There's the diversity of approach and family balance and wellness, so you can get educational information and life information all in one place. And you'll discover resources, support, and curriculum options that are at your disposal so you can educate by design and not default. In addition to that, you'll learn how to implement healthy lifestyle choices for the whole family because healthy input equals healthy output. No matter which path you choose to follow from an education standpoint, in order for your family to flourish, emotional, physical, and mental well-being are your pillars for success. The summit is designed so you'll leave with a new perspective about learning, parenting, and balance. Obviously, I haven't experienced the summit yet, not personally, because it doesn't start for a couple days after this originally airs on Mighty Parenting. What I do know is that this information is needed. I've been having a lot of conversations with parents about education. I've been sharing our experiences because we've been through private school, public school, and homeschool. And what I've found is there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of concern, and there's a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding around other options, especially homeschooling. There are a lot of options out there. They take a variety of forms, and exploring them and figuring out what will and won't potentially work for your family is kind of a big job, right? So the summit is helping to bring that to you, to make that much easier for you to navigate. So if you're worried about school or you had a less than stellar experience last year, check out the summit. If you've been struggling with COVID and want to learn more about being an emotionally, mentally, physically healthy family, check out the summit. It's running free for 3 days. You can register and get all the details on their website, getting-it-together.heysummit.com, and I'll add a link to that in our show notes as well. After you attend the summit, let me know what you think of it. Let me know if there's something I should be sharing with other Mighty Parents to help them on their journey as well.
This episode of the Mighty Parenting Podcast is sponsored by Inward Bound Mindfulness Education, IBME. Inward Bound Mindfulness Education believes young people deserve our best attention and support. And in order to create that support, they provide in-depth mindfulness programs for teens and young adults, helping them learn awareness, compassion, and concentration practices on retreats and during summer courses. And they have everything online for summer of 2020. IBME's mindfulness practices help with deep listening skills, self-awareness, and communication, essential competencies for success in all areas of life. And now they've expanded their offerings for adults, including a summer course for parents. You can find out about this and more at ibme.com, ibme.com. When you get there on the main page, you'll see a spot where you can enter your email address. Do that so you stay updated on programs and events and find out about new course offerings. Then if you look just above that, a little to the right, there is a beautiful nature photo and it says new courses and offerings, new online courses and offerings. Click that picture and it'll take you straight to what they have so you can see what's happening to help you and your teen this summer.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I'm Sandy Fowler, stress relief coach, emotional wellness speaker, and host of the Mighty Parenting podcast. And thank you so much for being here today, for tuning in, and for sharing the podcast with other parents. You are the best way for other parents to learn about the information we're sharing here so they can get support on their parenting journey. And speaking of support, be sure to pop on over and join our Facebook group, Mighty Parenting on Facebook. And there you can learn more, ask questions, or just get into the loop. Today, we are digging into a topic that can impact our children's lives in so many ways. The teen years are a very interesting time of life. It's a time when our kids are trying to figure out who they are, what they really love, what they believe in. They have a tendency to feel strongly about various topics and about injustice when they see it. And it's a time when they're developing a sense of self and self-worth, which is also greatly impacted by feeling like they have a purpose. We've talked about that on the show, right? That our kids need that purpose. Well, today's guest will be talking to us about an idea that actually hits on all of these areas. His name is Todd Hazak-Lowy. And he is the author of several books for young readers, including the one which is at the core of today's discussion. And it is We Are Power, How Nonviolent Activism Changes the World. Todd, thanks so much for joining us on Mighty Parenting today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I am curious, Todd, what sparked your interest? Like, what made you want to write about nonviolent activism?
The book I wrote before this book was something I actually co-wrote with a woman named Susan Zimmet. It's a book for around the same age group, and it's called Roses and Radicals, and it's about the American suffrage movement. And I really enjoyed that project. And when I got to the end of it, I wanted to do something somewhat similar, by which I mean write a history for young readers. And I looked for a while for a topic that would excite me and that felt sort of relevant for this moment. And eventually I got to nonviolence. And I should say that, you know, when I first started considering the topic, it was not a topic that I was remotely an expert on. I think I had the general understanding that most of us do, that there's this thing called nonviolence and there's this guy called Gandhi and Martin Luther King. And so for me, it was very much a kind of a started as out of a curiosity. And then the more I worked on it, I sort of understood why I was glad that I was writing this book. And that is because it's a book that really feels like it's both kind of a guide and an inspiration for the readers, that this is a way to affect change And here are people that did it against very unlikely odds and made the world, their communities, their country, a better place. So that was sort of my story of how this book happened and how I think about it now.
Well, it certainly is timely. Even just the two main things going on in the States today with COVID, and that people are getting very upset about both sides of that. And then we have the racism coming up again, right? That this is another turning point in that history of how Blacks are treated in our society. And so I think the book is certainly very timely. And you got to the core of that when you went, this is a way to affect change. And your book is actually written for, you mentioned the age range. I don't know what your exact age range is. What are you aiming for here?
Officially, the book is for ages 10 to 14. I think it reads up a little bit. And the other thing I mention is that, you know, as I said about myself, and this seems to be true with 99% of the adults I talk to, is that very few people know most of the information in the book, most of the histories, let alone most of the sort of theory in it. And so I've found that adults really like reading this. I also sort of somewhat darkly joke that, you know, during the pandemic, everybody's attention span is not what it was. And so for adults that are having trouble getting through a book, it might be time to pick up something that's for a 14-year-old. It might be just what fits your attention span. So that's the audience for the book.
Well, and that's why I asked, because I'm thoroughly enjoying it. I admit I have not quite finished it yet, but I have been thoroughly enjoying it. And one of the things I appreciate is that it's giving me the information about what happened. But like you said, it doesn't go into some of the extreme detail that, say, an adult version of the book would go into. And aside from attention span, I get to learn about a wider range of things in a shorter time period. It's one of the reasons I've always turned toward picking up even little kids' books. I did that when my kids were really young. I discovered at the library that when there was a topic I knew absolutely nothing about, the best place to start was in even the picture books, just to get that really big overview of, like, these are the three main points about this subject. And then I could start digging into more and more. And so I like it. I told you before the show that I'm going to be sharing it with my daughters, and we'll see if it sparks their interest. Even if it doesn't, there's going to be part of it that's going to be required reading for them, because I think they need to understand pieces of this. And so one of the other things that I liked, it was on, I believe it was on your website, where you had the video about the mean coach. And I want to start there before we back up and go to some of the basics of what is nonviolent activism and how is that different from other types of activism and why does it work? And we'll go through that. But the idea that our kids can have power to change their lives. You know, I was talking about some of these scenarios at the beginning, and it's so important for our kids to feel like they have purpose, like they have a voice, like they have power. I think that those are important aspects of their self-esteem, their self-confidence, their resilience in this world. And so I'd like to actually have you share a little bit of the story of the mean coach that you teach about through that video.
Sure. So this is a video that's about 3 minutes in length, and it was a way for me to try and create something that would give people a very basic introduction to one of the most central ideas of the book, that essentially is the title of the book, We Are Power. And I told a story about, and it's, you know, animated, I did not do the animation, about it, sort of a youth soccer team that's coached by a mean, unfair coach. And it tells the story basically of a player standing up to the coach and the player getting punished for doing so. And then eventually the player, sort of somewhat through conversation with other players, but more by sticking to her opposition to the coach, eventually wins over the other players. And what is revealed in this is perhaps the central truth of the entire book, which is that, you know, when you have a group of people that band together, even if they appeared sort of weaker or powerless prior to doing this, that they have power, and that the figure of authority actually doesn't have power. He only or she only has power when people agree to give that person power. So that was, you know, the video was meant to illustrate that in a very simple way. But as I say at the very end of the video, you know, what's true of a soccer team is true of the world. And, you know, one of the things we're seeing right now in the United States is that when lots of people decide that they are going to disrupt things and challenge authority, that authority has some limited options of how to respond to that. And in fact, when they attempt to sort of reassert their authority, it often backfires. And that's very much what we've been seeing over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, and it's interesting. So let's go to the explanation of what is nonviolent activism.
Yeah. So as I define nonviolent activism, I make a distinction between other kinds of activism and what I call nonviolent activism. And I think the best way to think about this is to think about the difference between, say, if you want a change in your community, you can have a petition that people sign, you can go and talk to the city council, you can ask to meet with other elected representatives, you can hold an event at the library to talk about this. And these are all instances of what is referred to as institutional activism, right? So there are existing channels that are set up, at least in a kind of open democratic society, that give people that don't have official power in that society to have their voices heard and to ask for change and agitate for change. My book is about moments in which those channels are either not accessible to people or are being unfairly regulated, and people elect instead to create movements and to initiate actions that essentially break the rules in order to change the rules. So a really good example of this historically is the women's suffrage movement, which existed for over a half century, almost exclusively limited to those kind of institutional actions. And then in the final decade of that movement, the movement sort of got more radical and started picketing and getting arrested and going on hunger strikes in order to finally sort of force the issue. And I think it had a lot to do with why ultimately the 19th Amendment was passed and women were claimed the right to vote. So my book, again, is looking at especially those moments in which there's more disruptive activism taking place. Though in all of these stories, this is intertwined with the other kind of institutional activism.
Yeah, that was interesting to me how actually the two are kind of working together, whether it's institutional first and then more of the nonviolent, but even during nonviolent, they end up kind of working together. So could you talk a little bit more about specifically what some forms of nonviolent activism look like?
Sure. So the overarching kind of category is that it is disruptive, right? So that if we think about any kind of injustice, it's an injustice that is a feature of the status quo. And that is something that the people sort of in power, the people with privilege, the people with wealth are interested in maintaining because it serves them. And the people that are trying to change that are people that necessarily what they have to do sort of first and foremost is to interrupt that status quo. So a classic example of this, and one that most everybody is familiar with, is the strike, right? So if you are working somewhere and you don't think the working conditions are fair, the pay isn't enough, that people are being exploited in one way or another, if one person quits, that does nothing, right? I mean, it gets you out of the job. I won't do this job anymore. But if you convince some large number of people that you work with to go on strike, then the owner or the boss or whoever benefits from treating the workers poorly is suddenly stuck because they can't produce whatever they're producing or offer whatever service they're offering in order to make money. And so that's a situation in which we see an interruption of the status quo that finds the seemingly weaker party in a conflict claiming power. There's other things like a boycott kind of works at the other end of that. But large marches and demonstrations can do the same. And then interestingly, there are literally 200 or more tactics that have been noted over time. So there's sit-ins, there's die-ins, there's obstructing traffic, et cetera, et cetera.
And within this, you've talked about how nonviolent activism doesn't mean peaceful. You said you're going to disrupt the status quo. You actually need to create conflict. You just want it to be nonviolent conflict. Is that?
Absolutely. Right. So this is, I think this is the first thing that is counterintuitive when you begin to study nonviolence, because people hear nonviolence and they think, oh, okay, this is somebody who's not using violence, so they must be passive or non-confrontational or something like that. And it's that's a misconception. And so one of the ways I talk about it in the book is I talk about it as this, what I call a third way. So if you're in conflict with someone who appears stronger than you, it would appear that you have two options. The first is to fight them violently, and the second is to submit. And those are obviously uninviting each in their own way. To have a violent conflict with someone who's stronger than you is to basically know you're going to lose and suffer in the process. And then to submit is obviously not to make things any better. And the sort of genius of nonviolence that Gandhi didn't so much discover as sort of rediscover and then apply in the modern times is that I can create conflict and conduct conflict in a way that does not require violence, but in a way that gives me access to power. And so, I was looking at a book about him the other day, and the cover of the book was basically called His Philosophy of Conflict. So I think one of the things that I find very interesting about this is that, speaking personally, I'm a person who does not like confrontation. I think it's one of the reasons I became a writer and a professor. I like to be left alone. I like to just think my thoughts and write my ideas out. And I think that part of me had me feel like conflict is intrinsically a bad thing. And one of the lessons I took from studying this history and these various movements is that there's a very sort of honorable and necessary and courageous way to work toward necessary conflict, but in a way that does not increase violence. And also in a way that ultimately views everybody in the conflict as working towards some common end, right? Which is getting rid of an injustice. So just the last thing on this answer is that Martin Luther King Jr. during the Birmingham campaign in 1963, he was talking about there are all these children that marched and got imprisoned, and he was speaking to his people the sort of the night after. There's like 1,000 or 2,000 of them in jail, and he says they're fighting to make this country better, right? So he wasn't saying they're fighting to make things better for blacks in the South, though obviously they were, but he truly believed that this was that there is an injustice in this country and it affects everyone, even those people who seem to benefit from it in some way, even those people who want it to continue. So I think it's one of the things that I find most impressive about nonviolence is it's really a way to fix a problem in which potentially everybody benefits from it. And it's not just one side winning and another side losing.
Well, and I know I've seen that with the call to anti-racism. It's in at least in the online part of the world that I'm in, there are all these people opening up channels for discussions, honest discussions, painful discussions, and looking for ways forward that are exactly that. And this isn't nonviolent activism, but it is tied into, it's one of the results of what is happening due to activism around the country. So I found that interesting. And that also raises the thought in my mind. So you talked about how there's necessary conflict in nonviolent activism. Mm-hmm. And we said, this is nonviolent. We keep saying it in the title. And yet, what we learn through history that you show us in the book is that doesn't mean that violence won't exist. So could you talk about that? Yeah, you know, it's not the activists, but it exists, right?
Right. Right. So this is a great point, and it answers the question in part of sort of, well, if we know what nonviolence is, why or how does it work? And part of the answer is what you just mentioned, that while the activist does not act violently, often what will happen through the creation of this conflict is that the stronger side is provoked and often will respond with violence, or at the least will respond with sort of what is called in the technical literature sanctions, right? So you can get fired if you go on strike. But what we see often is that it gets worse than that. And one of the reasons nonviolence works is that often when a person suffers and suffers publicly for standing up for something they believe in and challenging an injustice, is that other people take notice. So one of the other dynamics at work is we've been talking about this as a conflict, and there's two sides, and there's stronger and there's weaker. But almost always in a conflict of this sort, there's actually three groups, right? There's the people that are clearly the victims of injustice, and there's the people that are clearly sort of representing that injustice and enforcing it. But then there's everybody else who's sort of on the sideline. So we can look, for instance, at what's just happened in this country over the last couple of weeks. And we saw this dynamic play out really kind of to a T, as much as there was kind of other messier things happening simultaneously. So you had all sorts of protesters, the majority of which, perhaps the overwhelming majority of which, have been nonviolent. And then we saw in dozens of cities around the country, there was actually an article in the New York Times today that they have documented 98 cities in the country in which police use tear gas. And by using tear gas on what were predominantly nonviolent protesters, public opinion shifted in favor of the protesters, right? And you have, for instance, people that a month ago, if you had told them defund the police, they would say, you're a radical leftist, you're out of your mind. And whereas there are many people from the quote unquote mainstream that concept still makes them uneasy and they're not sure about it, it is now a mainstream concept. And so that is precisely a function of how nonviolent activism works, is that the side with power has used force and it has backfired on them. And this is called in the literature political jujitsu, right? Which refers to how to use someone else's force against them. So in that martial arts, a littler fighter can sort of, as the bigger fighter approaches and tries to take them down, can use them to their own force to turn them off balance, sort of flip them off balance. So that's what we've been seeing.
And all these others on the sidelines too, as you said, you know, there are some people who are going, yes, you know, now we definitely want to defund the police, or we don't. But there are a lot of people who are just going, well, let me look at this and let's talk about it. So even people who haven't necessarily sided one way or the other, there's a large group of people who are going, let's get educated. What does that mean? What are the actual problems here? And what are the best ways to solve them? Are we asking the police to do things that they shouldn't even be being asked to do? Should we be, you know, putting more of our focus into the social work or the other areas? The other piece that I wanted to talk about with this, though, is that this violence can come that people end up suffering. And that was one of the things that, as parents, we're listening, and some parents are probably going, why are we talking about this on this show? And part of the reason I wanted to talk about this is that we have kids. We have kids who get upset about a variety of injustices, whether it is the coach on the soccer team or what's happening on in our country or on the world stage. You talk in the book about Greta and her climate fight, right? This is a world stage and there are kids around the world getting involved in that. So wherever it is, our kids see an injustice or they feel oppressed or they see somebody else is oppressed and they want to do something about it. And as parents, I think that it's useful to understand this and to be able to educate our kids and go, well, this is what you got to think about. And one of the things that they have to think about is, are they willing to suffer for this? So can you talk a little bit about what happens with people suffering through this?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a variety of things that happen to people. Sometimes it's as simple as somebody gets arrested and maybe released shortly thereafter. But sometimes the, in the stories in this book, people get beaten and people get killed. And so, yes, I think from the perspective, if you're a parent of a teenager or a young adult who is feeling very energized and interested in and feels a kind of urgency around getting involved in what's going on right now, my advice to you would be to, you know, listen to what is animating your child, help them become aware of the risks that may be involved, make sure they understand what they're getting into. But I would also try to honor where that's coming from. I mean, I think one of the really interesting things about writing about this topic for young people is that one of the things that emerges from this is that this is a young person's game to a certain extent. And I use the word game perhaps inaccurately, but there is something about younger people that are A, more ready to take risk, and B, less ready to accept injustice. And so, you know, what we're seeing right now, and some of this is a function of COVID and older people deciding I can't go to a mass protest. It's too dangerous for me from a pandemic perspective. And we're seeing mainly young people doing this, but that is a function of them feeling like we can't accept something that for whatever reason, our parents and our grandparents' generations have more or less accepted. And so I think it does put, you know, a parent in a somewhat tricky position because our first inclination is always to protect our children. But I think it's necessary to take seriously what is motivating them to act in the first place. But simply, I would say not to be foolish about what one is doing, to understand what you're getting into.
And understanding, I think, is a key word here, because your book teaches us about nonviolent activism, but it also touches on this idea of institutional activism. And I loved in there, you had a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. after his home was bombed. A piece of the quote was, "We are not advocating violence. We want to love our enemies. We must meet hate with love." And so I think as a parent, having a conversation with my teen, young adult, even tween, possibly, if they are getting all heated up about something, to be able to take them to this place of saying, okay, well, here's what we've learned from history. Violence really is not a great solution. And it's something that when it's an individual or a small group, doesn't work. So there's nonviolent activism, but we can also have a conversation that says there's also institutional activism, and that can work in certain areas in certain times. So we can encourage them to consider that. We can also encourage them to consider other ways of approaching things with this idea of we must meet hate with love. And just to be in that space where you are willing to listen to somebody else and to maybe help educate them. Again, that goes back to these conversations that I said, you know, I've been participating in and seeing online, is that there are people who have been they have been victimized by different situations and through racism. And so what they're doing is they are hosting conversations and they're going, we get
that a lot of you don't understand what's been going on. So we're having conversations and there's back and forth, but everybody's meeting where they are and going, okay, whatever happens, I'm going to meet this person, all these people in this conversation with love. So I think that we can encourage them to go, you know, there are a few different roads here. You can go to institutional activism, you can go to nonviolent activism, and you can also just be, I think of it as institutional activism, but not through an institution. It's like word of mouth almost, of just educating and loving and helping people to move forward in terms of whatever cause you have. And as a parent, I love the idea that there are the things I can do besides encouraging them to use nonviolent activism, because there certainly can be a price to pay. And yet it's also something that I would really have to be proud of my child, that they are willing to take a hit to make the world a better place for other people. Because a lot of times, as you said, these changes go on for, you know, centuries.
Yeah. No, and I think it's also, I mean, just in terms of the, and I really don't want to make light of this at all, but, you know, I think one thing to be aware of is certainly in our society, we don't have a problem with the notion of sacrificing through military service, especially if we believe that the military conflict in question is a just one, right? So we don't take those, the injuries or deaths that come from that, lightly, but we think it is kind of quote unquote worth it, right? That is a sacrifice that has made our lives better, right? And I take some issue with that from some other perspectives, but my overall point is that I think when people sacrifice nonviolently for a cause they really believe in, that should be something that the society honors as well and take quite seriously. Again, I don't say any of that to suggest that we should be encouraging our children to do that if they don't want to do it. But if my child is coming to me interested to do that and seems to understand what they're getting into and can make a case for why they think this kind of conflict is necessary, then as a parent, I'm going to try to honor what they're doing. You know, and it's interesting, and historically, there's all these instances of Martin Luther King's father, who was a very influential preacher, I believe from Atlanta, who was pleading with his son to basically be less radical. And it was the same as this parental concern of you're gonna get hurt. You don't need to do this. And Martin Luther King Jr. said, this is what I have to do. This is how I'm going to make the country better and make things better for our people. So these dynamics are dilemmas are not simple at all.
No, but I think that the core conversation here, I think the book is a great conversation starter of just what do we believe in and how are we upholding that in the world? Like I said, it could be simple. It could just be in our daily example, in the way we lead our lives. It could be writing books. It could be all the way up the chain, right? As far as risk goes. But there are lots of ways to make a change. And I think that is probably really the heart of it for me as a parent, is going, okay, I read this book. I'm going to have my girls looking at this and reading this. I'm showing to my husband and go, okay, as a family, what do we believe in? What do we stand for? And it's a good reminder. You also had in the book, Todd, where you said, that truth always has a role in nonviolent activism, right? That there's some kind of injustice going on.
Absolutely.
That truth is there. But you also, I am quoting you from the book, said some truths, even after appearing to emerge victorious, may need to be fought for all over again. You know, we see these changes and we just assume that they're forever. And as women looking at the Middle East, you know, we can look at it and go, oh no, because women had freedom. And then it was taken away by the Taliban there. So we've seen in modern day world where those things can get taken away from us. And I think we as a cultural world, as societies, we need to decide, what do we stand for? What are we willing to stand up for? And what does that mean in our family, in our world? And I appreciate your book as a way of bringing that not easy a conversation to light for us to have with our families.
Yeah, I mean, the point you make about the truth is very important. So when Gandhi was first sort of discovering this method, he was Gandhi was actually a lawyer who was trained in England and wore a suit and looked as much as he could like a Westerner. And then he switches over and becomes a nonviolent activist. And when he does that, he tries to figure out what the name of this is going to be. And he kind of creates, with help from other people, this Indian term, satyagraha, which means holding firmly to the truth. So there's nothing in that term that's actually about nonviolence as such. But for him, and we can see this with all the way up to Greta Thunberg today with the climate movement, is that this is about, there's a truth that I believe in, and I'm going to speak this truth, and I'm going to act in service of this truth. And I think one of the things that comes out of that is, as we're seeing today, is that when people act nonviolently and create this kind of conflict, it becomes an occasion for more people to sort of have to confront that truth, right? So if we look at the, you know, the, I think a lot of white people in this country like to tell a story about race that's a story of progress. And one of the conversations that we're all having to have right now, especially in the white communities, is maybe that's not the most accurate way to tell that story. Maybe there's much more continuity in the story of race in America than we'd like to think. And so that has been a function of this movement, which has been both institutional and extra-institutional, is it's forcing us to have this conversation and confront a truth that is something that may not be very inviting for a lot of us to look at. And again, I think by acting nonviolently as opposed to violent, it makes people think, maybe there's something to what these people are doing. Maybe there's some principle behind their action. So that's what I think we're seeing right now in this country.
Yeah. And as you said earlier, when the bystanders, the third group, see people suffering for something, it catches your attention and makes you go, wow, there really must be something here. And so it opens up that world, that conversation. And like I said, you have opened up some great conversations for us to have as families. We will have a link to your book in the show notes for today's show. But for listeners who want more from you, Todd, where can they get that?
So you can go to my website, which is my last name without the hyphen. I assume people that listen to this podcast will be able to find my name somewhere.
It'll be in the show notes, yeah.
Yeah, so just mylastname.com and has information about this book as well as other books of mine. And I'm keeping up kind of a running, links to interviews I've had and pieces I've written and pieces that have been written about my book and also things that I think are relevant to nonviolent in this moment, both with regards to things having to do with race and the police, but also climate and other things. So there's, an endless amount of things to learn about this, and it's in the news all the time. So I do encourage people to keep their eye open for it, because I think we're clearly in this country going through a transformation, and hopefully it will be a nonviolent transformation. It does seem that one of the interesting side effects of this pandemic is it's helped people imagine and even just sort of live alternative futures. I often feel like, I've been joking with people that I sometimes feel like I'm in a period piece in the near future. Like, it doesn't feel like this is the world I knew 5 months ago. So, there's a transformation going on in this country, and I'm hopeful that it is a nonviolent one.
Me too. And yes, you're right. It is definitely a moment in time where I find myself saying, okay, and when I look back on this time from a few months or a year or a few years from now, what will I have wished I had done? Okay, let's just do it now. So This is a great piece of information for us and a way to open our eyes to different ideas. I appreciate you being on the show today, Todd, and for sharing these ideas with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And Mighty Parents, thank you for being here. If you enjoyed the podcast, then please rate, review, and share it. And then remember to visit mightyparenting.com, grab your email series on communicating with your teen. Remember, you hear, you're listening, you are a mighty parent, and you got this. I will see you next week.